jazz.
Busted.
So you coming at me live from San Diego?
I am.
All right. Welcome to Hotel San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
Can you leave? I guess you probably can if you want to.
I'm going to suck this time. I mean, really suck. I'm just telling you now.
Should I put this in the bumper or something? Mike's promise to you, the listener.
I promise to you, the listener, tonight I'm sucking.
He's going to make like a Dyson, people.
My apologies in advance to all our... My apologies in advance to all of the people we're going to be talking about.
Uh-oh. They're coming after you, man. They're all young.
I'm going to be speaking at a level of vagueness. I'm gonna dodge and weave like a politician. It's going to be awesome. I'm going to look like Biden at the debate when they ask you if you want to decriminalize immigration. I'll have like a finger in the air. Maybe.
All right.
Not going to be good.
We're ready, listeners, for Jazz Bastard Podcast 171. Making those big promises is Mike.
Yeah, I am setting the bar low tonight. I've listened to the albums. There we go. That happened. Repeatedly.
And so is Pat. Yes.
Yeah, and Pat's here. Sorry.
I would do my best.
So let me just explain to Spazza, Jonathan Crompton, Curtis Nowosad, and Chase Baird. Worthy players, worthy people all.
We want you to know the dog ate his homework. That's
I drove 3,000 miles.
Okay.
And came back, and I literally started teaching like 2 days later, and I'm having to start a second class next week, and I'm being hit up for book orders for fall courses. So it's like I arrived back into a shitstorm. So if I'm less than my usual scintillating and incredibly well-informed self, that's the reason why. It has nothing to do with the worthiness of the album. So tonight I'm riding in the, what do you call those little cars on the motorbikes? What do you call those?
The sidecar.
I'm in
I
the
believe.
Sidecar. Yeah.
Miles Davis has a song about that. And remember, meteorologists tell us the shitstorm is the third worst kind of storm you can encounter.
Yeah, like global warming. I'm in the sidecar tonight. You must take the lead here, or this will go not nearly as well as it should.
Those of you who've seen Duck Soup by the Marx Brothers know what happens to the sidecar. It just is continually left behind.
Right.
It's weird. I don't know. They should connect it to the motorcycle. It would work better. But
I am ready and willing to be left behind. And know that. deserve to be left behind. I'm not going to be good tonight. I'll do the best I can.
Okay. Well, Mike has already listed our artists for tonight. We are doing an all new release show. A couple of these albums were recorded a couple years back, but all of them are coming out in 2019. All of them are from fairly new artists and for the most part, fairly young artists. So we'll be looking at Curtis Nowosad's a self-titled debut album. He's a Canadian, born around 1988, roughly speaking. He's in his 30s. Chase Baird's album, A Life Between, is coming out this year. He's a saxophone player born in America. In fact, of the leaders, he's the only one who is quote-unquote American. Jonathan Crompton, originally an Australian, an alto saxophone player. His album recorded back in 17, but dropping now, is coming out. It's called Into It. And then finally, Spazza's self-titled album, Spazza. And that's one I've actually reviewed on All About Jazz a few weeks back. And their press representative said, they think you really got it. So, good. You know, I, to be honest, that was an album I had listened to repeatedly to make any sense of. I really like it. I think it's a great listen. It is the least traditionally jazz album in the mix. I highly recommend listening to it, but it's a little different. Maybe we'll save that for last. You recommended we put in Crompton's Into It, said I'd like that. I think you were right. ¶¶ So let's begin there, if that's okay with you.
That is fine.
Mike's fine. He's in the sidecar. He really doesn't care. He just wants to get to his destination.
Can you list the personnel, please, on Intuit? Jonathan Crompton's Intuit.
So Mr. Crompton's a composer, and he plays alto sax. Ingrid Lobrock, tenor saxophone player. She's on several.
We've talked about, haven't we?
You know, I don't think so, but her projects have been fairly well publicized. I think we've gotten a couple as review copies. I don't believe we've talked about one
really?
In depth.
I have at least one or two albums of hers that I've picked up just on my own. So for some reason, I thought we talked about her. All right,
yeah,
go ahead.
I pulled Ubatuba off eMusic, and then we got a review copy of another album of hers, which is quite fascinating. She's an avant-gardist. Patrick Breener, tenor saxophone and bass clarinet. Patrick Booth, tenor saxophone on a couple tracks, and Adam Hopkins bass, and Kate Gentile drums. So this is kind of an ensemble built out of bass, drums, and saxophone, and the number of saxophones varies from track to track.
It sort of has that clarinet family, Hamiet Bluiett feel a little bit because of all of the reed work here.
Yeah, there's some. This is an album that it really struck me that the way they order the songs is a bit misleading because the first track is, to my mind, the most out, the most
yep.
dissonant, the most formless. And then pretty much everything after that's easier sledding. And I don't know, people don't, for the most part, listen to records anymore. I was just listening to a record on Spotify, and if you do it on your cell phone and you don't give them $10 a month, they force you to shuffle. So it may be that, you know, for most people, I don't know whether people crank up Jonathan Crompton on their Spotify subscriptions or whatever, but, you know, it may not matter. But to me, as someone who listens to an album typically from beginning to end, I found the first track a little, I don't want to say off-putting, but just disorienting, because it kind of implied, I mean, when you hear a track like that, you think, we're going to be in a certain sound world. It's going to be very freeform. There's not going to be identifiable
yep.
melodies or rhythms. And this is all going to be
those weird yips and zips. And
right,
it sounds
yeah.
like, it sounds like you're at the deep end of the David Murray pool, or maybe even Steve Lacy at his most, you know, at his most rebarbatively difficult. And yeah, you're exactly right. That first cut, you're like, oh man, what am I in for? And I can remember, I've mentioned this many times, you know, I'll listen to an album once through, and then if it's for the podcast, it goes into a playlist, and then it's shuffled. And every time Intuit came up, I would have to stop and go, wait, who is this? Because it doesn't sound, you're right, it doesn't sound anything like the sound world of the rest of the album, which is much more welcoming.
Yeah, it's more excessive. Yeah, and Mike's referring to such well-known Steve Lacy albums as Snips, Whips, and Kicks in the Balls. I made those titles
no,
up.
Things like Chirps.
Exactly. I wasn't that far off.
That's the real name of a Steve Lacy album, Chirps. Not making that up. And there's some more in that
right.
sound work. So yeah, Intuit starts out that way. It's not, we should be nice, it's not nearly as challenging. I mean, it's challenging, you know, but it's not Steve Lacy absolute. It's not that bad, I guess. That's what I want to say.
Well, dry. Steve is
not that dry. That's a good way to put it.
And the Soprano is a very uncompromising sound. And I love a lot of Steve Lacy stuff, but some of it can be a little bit hard to face in the morning if you got a hangover. And I don't quite suss out how that was put together. I understand that as a second to last track,
right,
where you feel like people have bought into what you're doing and you're ready mm-hmm. to stretch them a bit, and then you settle things down with the last track and everybody's happy again and you go home. But as a first track with an album this, you know, I mean, again, if it was a first track of a strictly avant-garde, free-form kind of, you know, let's try our altissimo and alternative sound gig thing, it's fine. You know, nothing wrong with that. But given what else is coming down the pike, which is, you know, time's a little bit third streamy. There was some old-fashioned saxophone quartet I had listened to once. It was like the Manhattan Saxophone. I can't remember the name of it. But a little bit like that, you know, the kind of a third streamy 30s style saxophone music, not quite that old-fashioned, but, you know, a little bit of that sound, very different from Intuit, the title track.
Yeah, although, to be fair, I mean, so the following two cuts are much more accessible, and they have a lot of sweet replaying kind of together. But then some of the later cuts get a little more challenging again. Dreaming has some skippy, I don't know what to call it. It doesn't quite get into multiphonics, but it gets a little abrasive at points. And the misleadingly titled Suite in A Major is not really sweet. It has stretches where we get these sort of dissonant reed combos playing off one another, but there are also just some spiky, improvisational, closer to out things here. I wanted to ask you on this album what you thought of the drummer in particular.
Yeah, we can hear him just a little bit. Boy, I've listened to it several times, but I don't know that I've sussed what she's up to. So, I mean, nothing bad, nothing good. As a saxophone player, I'm extremely biased to listening to my kind.
I think she's got the most difficult seat in the house on this album. I think it's a tough road to hoe to play accompaniment for this. And I like some of the things she gets up to, but there are times where I get in that world saxophone quartet mode, and I kind of just want to hear the reeds play with each other.
Yeah.
And I will admit,
not really a reflection on her, but more just the conception isn't sort of choir drums.
I just kind of was into their sound world, and I'll be honest, I had to turn up the volume a lot and put on the big boy headphones to catch the bass at all. Just listening to this on small headphones, no good. You really have to have the sound system primed to catch what the bass player is doing, which again is fine. I like what the rhythm players are doing. It's just that I'm kind of really interested in the sound world that the reed players were creating. And when the rhythm section dropped out, it was okay. Like I didn't get them back right away. You know,
and again, we're not criticizing their playing. No. Just it's more that the conception of the album doesn't scream out for them, because it is, as you say, close to a saxophone choir kind of album. At least half the tracks.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is one I did not play in the car, and I drove a lot. I was a lot on the road. Last weekend, we went to Cincinnati, and I'll talk about that more at the end of the show. And on that drive there, I was on my own, so I got to listen to music. But this one is just such that it is the most sit down in a chair and listen of these albums.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. I know. I think it's rewarding, though. I mean, some of the numbers are really, some of the numbers are quite sweet.
Yeah.
December is really lush and kind of gorgeous. So, it repays close listening. And like I said, if you want to catch what the rhythm section, particularly the bass player, is doing, you really have to turn this up with the big boy headphones, or you're just not going to hear what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah. I liked it quite a bit. As a record, I think its difficulty is trying to, so it was a Hollywood saxophone quartet I was thinking of from episode 104.
I almost bought that. Yeah.
It's an oddity that I ran across that I kind of enjoy, but very much of its time. This album is not like that, but it does have moments of fairly, as you say, sweet writing, a number of saxophones, and it's about a kind of almost gentle blending of third string with jazz impulses. I'd say, you know, more towards the jazz end of the spectrum, but there's a little hint there. And those are just so different in feel and conception from Intuit and a couple of the harder edge pieces that you almost feel like it's, and we talk a lot about the contract a record is making with the listener. And of course, ideally for artists, it's like, well, you're going to listen to whatever I want to play. Just shut up. But in the real world, we're fitting music into our lives, and we are kind of looking for what the expectations you've got. And I think, you know, as listeners, we try to be pretty flexible. If Albert Eiler wants our attention, you know, we're going to gird our loins and say, okay, Albert, you can have me for 35 minutes. But we kind of know what the rules are, which is, you know, brace yourself. in Opera's right. case. And you're kind of putting yourself in the mind space to deal with that. This album is a little hard to fix on what the rules are or what the expectations are. I think it is listening closely.
Yeah.
You can't really put this on the background in a party or in the car, partially because the rhythm, the drums, and the bass aren't mixed very high and they aren't very featured. These aren't songs of forward rhythmic propulsion for the most part. But there's also this question of, you know, well, how atonal is this going to be? How freeform? Is this about writing? Is it more about performance? I think largely it's more about writing. I don't know. I mean, as a soloist, I don't know. I mean, he seems fine, but I don't know that I think of him as a blower right now. I don't feel like I know him as a blower. He may be great. You know, he may be able to really rip apart, you know, the bebop standards, but this album is not so much about that. I didn't know if you had anything else to come there. And I thought,
I was just listening. It was good. I'm listening to you.
That's right.
I'm in the sidecar.
He's hanging in the sidecar. He's like moving that scarf, you know, so it stays behind his neck. It's not bunching up, just in the goggles. Everything's cool. So yeah, I like it.
Okay, Pat's wandering. So, in sum, this is pretty good. It's a lot of fun. Well, fun's not the right word. It's a good listen. We enjoyed it. We're not sure where Crompton's going, but
right.
For people who like, let's put it this way, if you like, as we do, bass clarinet, and if you like saxophone quartet, you will probably like this. You will even like this if you're kind of into some Steve Lacy squonking, you know? But if you're into propulsive blues driven jazz, you're not gonna like this very much. It's not gonna be your cup of tea.
Right.
Not as many out moments as there are in moments, but enough out moments to lend fiber to what is sometimes a very sweet and lush listening experience. Eh?
All right. Very well summed, Mr. Sidecar. So our next selection, Chase Baird, saxophone player, in his 30s as well. This album had to be listened to because the piano player on the date is Brad Meldow, he of the body pillow that Mike clutches every night, St. Brad. Antonio Sanchez is on drums. Chase plays saxophone. Nir Felder on guitar. And Dan Shimlinski, I'm going to guess, on bass. So this is a quintet most of the time. I don't think, you know, not every number features every player, but for the most part, it's a quintet. The guitar gets featured in different ways here. This is another one that kind of plays does a fake out with the first number.
It does. So that's the first thing I wanted to ask you about. What is that, what are they name checking with that? Is that Black Sabbath or?
What it reminds me of in a vague way is Kashmir by Led Zeppelin.
That's right. I knew it was something that I had heard and I couldn't figure out what it was, but you know, the beginning of Ripcord, sounds like the beginning of Kashmir. It's that and then suddenly it turns into a song.
Yeah, and again, you know, I'm showing my age, as I so often do. For me, the first track on an album, and I know that's an archaic concept at this point, archaic maybe is the word I'm looking for, maybe anarchic as well, should establish kind of a rough idea of where we're headed. And the beginning of the song implies we're going to have some kind of weird melding of jazz and rock. 70s style rock, and it's going to be heavily distorted electric guitar and then this otherwise acoustic ensemble trying to kind of interact with that. And again, interesting thesis there, but that's not where the paper goes. As an old English prof would say, it kind of veers off, as I often do myself, into other areas. So we don't get a lot more of Mr. Heavy Metal Guitar. I mean, he plays more. He plays on many of the tracks, but not in that style for the most part. So I don't quite know what the point of that was. It's setting you up for one set of expectations, which I think could have been kind of interesting. Heavy metal meets out jazz.
It certainly got my attention. I was like, whoa, what is this?
Right, yeah.
And then it settles down into something a little more familiar, maybe too familiar, from contemporary jazz. Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead. Well, so I have some questions about this. I have some general questions when Brad becomes an accompanist and when he does accompaniment. So when I've got a bunch of discs where he's second banana, second fiddle. I've got a Renee Fleming disc, for God's sakes, where she's singing, you know. So here's the question I have about this. On the one hand, you've got this guy, Chase Baird, you know, has pictures of Brad Meldow. Compromising pictures, or he's his best friend, or something. He knows him, so he gets him on the album, right? Because I've never heard.
He's got a picture of Brad smiling, and so I'm like, okay, you gotta repress this. I'll do anything just to let it out. At least,
yeah.
Happy Brad.
No diss to Chase Baird. But Brad Meldow is extremely established at this point, and Chase Baird is relatively new. So when you get a major player as a side guy on an album, on the one hand. There's a tough needle they have to thread. You want them to play nice and to support, you know, the leader on the date. By the same token, if they have like an incredibly distinctive voice, if they have a pretty recognizable style, you sort of want that foregrounded, but you don't want it like too foregrounded or, you know, takes over the album, right? So it feels to me like, you know, between the Scylla of dominating the album and the Charybdis of disappearing, this feels closer to Charybdis. This feels closer to Meldow. So tamping down maybe is not the right word, but playing nice so much that I lose some of the sense of what makes him so distinctive as a player and why then someone might want to have him on their date. It's not that the piano playing here isn't terrific. It is. It's just, he really does kind of blend back into the ensemble, doesn't he?
Yeah, and even his solos, it seems to me, to the nature of the writing, the methodology of them, the shape of them, seems kind of dictated by the context, which I'm going to say this was the album that, you know, is extremely accomplished. Sanchez is a fine drummer. You know, it's a great ensemble, but it was the least appealing to me. The soloing, you know, he apparently the leader Baird studied under was discovered by Michael Brecker. And there is that very technically accomplished, very notey solo style that I just felt like the structures that he set up in the songs kind of stood in place. You know, the chord changes did not. The cure I had for this was I put on some Dexter Gordon. It's like there's going to be chord progression and Dexter's going to play some motherfucking choruses over it. And it's going to have a story. It's not going to be the most advanced story. But I'm going to know when I come to the end of each chorus because he and every fucking member of the rhythm section is going to signal it with a big red flag. And, you know, I'm going to feel like progress was made. And at the end of it, he's going to play that melody again and I'm going to be a happy little boy. And, you know, Dexter's got his limits for me. But that was kind of, this is the kind of music that makes me want to listen to Dexter Gordon. And that it just, you know, the cyclical chord changes that don't ever quite commit themselves to a harmonic progression because that'd be not quite sophisticated enough. And the really intricate solos that just flow and go and there's all these notes and they don't seem to say anything to me emotionally or narratively. but they're very impressive. I mean, as a saxophone player, I know I could never do this in my lifetime. I'm not trying to diss him as a musician. He's really accomplished, and this group is obviously accomplished. But even Brad, you know, I listen to him thinking, well, I can hear him. When he solos, I'm aware of it. He's not doing some of the things he's best known for because he's got less flexibility than he does, let's say, in his trio. But he's also playing on these chord patterns that he's manfully producing kind of these intricate spun out lines that I'm impressed every minute I hear them, and I forget them the minute they're done. You know, they don't stick. And so this was right. The one listening, you know, loudly in the car and focusing on. I was kind of ready for it to be done by the end, despite the fact highly accomplished, great musicians. And it may be that I just don't care for Mr. Baird much as a composer, or it may be that he's still in the phase of his career where he's showing people that he's a really badass saxophone player. I don't know.
Are these all original compositions?
You know, this is a problem I've run into before, and I apologize for. And if I was a little bit more diligent, and I don't have Mike's excuses, so I, you know, will plead 4 days in Cincinnati, which will humble any person, especially when it's 95 in the zoo. But they don't tend to give you that information in the promo stuff.
Right.
And since these albums are often not quite out yet or barely out, it's a little hard to track down. I guess I'm assuming they are because I don't recognize any of the names. And because, to be honest, I don't know why you take these songs from somebody else. You know,
right.
In other words, I don't know that you, if I was going to go looking for a sack of songs, I'd look harder. You know,
the only one that I kind of questioned or wondered about was, well, the opener, only because Meldo has that rock. He has that rock out thing in his bag. He does that. And also the closer, not least because of the bizarre German title, Im wunderschönen Monat Mai.
Yeah.
But also because that's the prettiest playing Meldo does on the record by far. And he gets the most space in that song.
Yeah, maybe those are ones he brought to the table.
It sounds the most like himself there.
Well, the German is a
well,
symptom.
I don't know. Anyway, like I said, when you have, when a relative newcomer has a big, famous, heavy hitter on the album, you have this problem of how much is too much and how much is not enough. And this felt like a little not enough because Baird is a good player. And I guess I would have liked to see him strike a few more sparks with Meldau being a little more combative.
Yeah.
And he's in the sidecar. and it feels like Brad should be trying to grab the wheel more often, and then Baird can fight him off. And that might have produced a few more sparks here. Because, like you said, the playing here is of a very high level. It's really good, but I have a hard time remembering any of these numbers with the exception of the opening of Ripcord and Meldau's playing on the closer in Wunderschönen. The stuff in between is good. I like it.
Sehr gut.
I don't remember any of the melodies. None of it. It didn't stick with me. So yeah, I'm left with this feeling of someone with great technical facility, but these aren't, and maybe that's the point, you know, these aren't tunes that are sticking in my head, and that's okay. They don't have to. Whenever I listen to this, I'm going to enjoy it, and I'm going to pay attention because it kind of rewards attention. But yeah, it doesn't seem to have struck as many sparks as it could. When you have someone like Meldau in your group, it feels to me like you want to milk that cow a little more than he gets milked here.
Milk the Meldau, a new title for the episode.
Milk the Meldau.
That's an image that I'm going to have to really scrub out of my mind for the next few weeks.
You better be careful. You put that up, and we may be getting a letter from Brad's lawyers at some point.
Yeah, I don't think that's
enough
be,
with no. the jokes.
Yeah, so we're gonna leave that out. Well, I think I gotta say the question was in my mind. I feel like Meldau really does melt into the background in many cases, and so this one I felt like I was aware of his presence, especially as a soloist, in a way that sometimes he's. But I absolutely agree. You know, when I used to go to Gympa in Sweden, it took me months to figure out that there's this green ear outlined in lights on the wall. And then I finally realized what this ear was, this sign kind of, this electrical thing, was that it would glow red or orange if the decibels got dangerously loud. Because, of course, all exercise in Sweden must be accompanied by techno, right? Or some kind of, you know, music remixed as techno. And I sometimes think studios of jazz musicians, they should have an ear that glows red if you've taken too many choruses. Because I think Chase here, almost every song would have benefited from like one or two fewer choruses. You know, it's just like, it's amazing. He is really a fine player. And, you know, as a gunslinger, I'm like, dude, I bow to your prowess. But as music to listen to, and, you know, Brecker would do this sometimes too. It's just like, I like more narrative. I like more nuance and emotion. Fewer notes and probably a couple fewer choruses in most cases.
You sound like the aristocrat. I forget who he was in Mozart.
There you go. Know. Too many notes. Oh,
too many notes. Too many notes.
And apparently this guy was actually a fairly bright music enthusiast, but they made him a dork in the movie, just like they made Salieri evil villain.
Right. And also a talentless hack, which he wasn't.
Yeah, poor guy. Anyway, it's all about the narrative. Yes, I'm a little bit that way. And I think that guy would have said the same thing to Michael Brecker, who might have punched him. I don't know. But yeah, sometimes it's like, yeah, you know, listen to some Johnny Hodges here.
Before we move on, I was going to say, can you think of an example? Because Melda has appeared on, he's done this before with some other people, Joel Fromm, and I think we talked about his album, The Navigator.
And there's like a couple with Konitz, and is it Hayden maybe? You know, those trios that I always felt like are going to be brilliant and then turned out to be kind of...
Right. So I was thinking of the earlier example of Meldau with Fromm. That's pretty good. It feels like Meldau there. And I was wondering, can you think of an example where an established player is brought in on a date with someone and enhances and kind of brings something to that date, but doesn't overshadow it? Because I can think of, if I think hard, I'm sure I can think of several where that guy or that woman overshadows the new guy.
Just outweighs it. That's an interesting question. I should go back and just kind of systematically look through the stack. But in the moment, you know, the big guest star, I mean, so much of what I got is of an era where,
well, I mean, think about like Monk with Blakey, right?
Yeah, well, and I guess a classic example, maybe because I was listening to one of their LPs recently, was a Clifford Brown Max Roach quintet, where I think it was Harold Land was the saxophone player. And Sonny Rollins comes in when Land decides to go back to California because his grandma is sick or something. I can't remember the reason. Maybe it's his mother. And, you know, Rollins, I don't think anyone on earth is going to argue that Rollins that Land is a better player than Rollins. I think it's God would agree that Rollins is a more impressive player. But a lot of people argue that in that quintet, Land was a better fit. You know, so it's one of those things where chemistry matters sometimes as much as just sheer talent. And Meldau, to some degree, you know, he's nothing. His methodology is nothing like Rollins per se, but he's one of these guys that benefits from a lot of room to work. He's got a lot of things
and friction. He benefits from having someone, you know, the whole point of his trio is that there is real tension there, you know.
Day is done, and that's a banger, man.
Oh,
that's when the new drummer's there. That's a fucking banger.
Jeff Ballard, new drummer and it's like new fire, you know. And not the first Meldau Matheny meeting, but I think the second one. There's like a live one, and it's like they kind of rocked it. It's like, here's how this works. Here's how we, you know, fire off.
Yeah, we talked about one, but I think it was the studio. I don't know if I've heard the live one, because the studio one is a little pretty. You know, it's a little not bad.
Everyone's being nice. Yeah, I'll give you another example because I just started listening to it again today. I just made it into the rotation. One of the last records Doc Cheetah made, it may in fact have been the last record he made, was a date with Nicholas Payton. Doc Cheetah and Nicholas Payton. And no one in their right mind, I think, would argue that Doc Cheetah is a better trumpeter than Nicholas Payton. Payton is, he's puckish. He's awesome. He's Wynton Marsalis with a sense of humor. He's fantastic. And Doc Cheetah and he play together and Cheetah sings. And you have the sense that Payton is Payton, but, you know, he adds, like, it's good that he's there.
And he finds a place and
Right. The interplay, particularly when both of them are playing trumpet, the interplay is really good. It works out really well. And that's definitely a case where you sort of get someone young and hot in, and it worked out well. You know, it worked out really well.
And we've talked at length and bring up frequently when this kind of meeting of the masterminds goes wrong.
Yeah.
Money Jungle would be an example of that, that we talk about Money Jungle on episode 35, as well as Terry Lynn Carrington's kind of cover or meditation on that album, Money Jungle Provocative in Blue, on episode 35. But yeah, Duke Ellington, Charles Mingus, and Max Roach in a trio, and at elbows are out there. It's kind of a rough ride.
Yeah, it's not a happy day.
Glad it happened, but it woo, a
it's
little
like
rough.
One of these guys isn't as talented as the other, but his ego might be twice as large as theirs combined. Not going to go well.
It's I'm not a real aficionado of this more, it's probably too harsh to call it technocratic, but very technical, very sort of oblique, harmonically focused playing.
Right.
But, you know, Chase is young and he may just knock me on my ass the next album. He certainly impresses the hell out of me as a player.
Yeah.
And it's always nice to hear Brad in different contexts. But this is probably the four of them, the album I'm going to turn to least just for pure pleasure.
Right.
So coming up next, a Canadian, Curtis Nowosad. He's a drummer. He was born around 88. He's in his 30s. And he's put together a group with Dwayne Eubanks on trumpet, Braxton Cook on alto sax, Andrew Renfro on guitar, Jonathan Thomas on piano and other keyboards, and Luke Selick on bass. And what I don't have here for some reason is the name of the vocalist who appears on a couple of these tracks. It takes on a couple covers, and it's got a bit of a political vibe to it, but it also gets very mellow at times. So what do you think of
which are the covers, by the way?
So Home Is Where the Hatred Is, I believe, is okay. A cover, and the Hard Time Killing Floor Blues,
oh,
I'm assuming.
Course,
and I Sea Lion Woman, I'm assuming, is a some
oh,
kind of
probably right, and I can't think now who that would be.
Let's see here.
So
Nina Simone sings it.
Favorite? It's got to be older than that. Anyway, neither here nor there. So, for no very good reason, for a reason, I don't know if it's a good reason, the cut that kind of sticks with me, besides Sea Lion Woman, because of the vocal kind of sticks with me, is Never Forget What They Did to Fred Hampton.
Yeah. I had to look him up. I felt bad, but
dude, every day. Oh my God. Now I'm going to have to jump on you. Every day walking to the gym to play basketball. If you recall 56th Street, there was an apartment building and the alley side before you got, if you're walking down 56th toward the gym where we spent a lot of time throwing up bricks, someone had spray painted a line about Fred Hampton. All those years later, it was still there. And I forget the exact line, but it was something about Fred Hampton lives, or, you know,
yeah, he was
blah,
murdered
blah, blah.
In his sleep in Chicago. So yeah, the vocalists are Michael Mayo and Brianna Thomas. Sorry about that.
Right.
They're guests.
So So yeah, when I heard that song, I was like, Fred Hampton, Fred Hampton. Yeah, Fred Hampton, a Black Panther, African-American activist who was killed along with someone else in a raid in Chicago by the Chicago police, famous event in the city of Chicago. So I was struck with the fact that a Canadian has on his album. Never forget what they did to Fred Hampton. I was like, damn, dude. I wanted to ask you, is Eubanks part of the Eubanks clan? Is he related to the other Eubankses out there in the jazz world? Kevin, and who's the other Eubanks?
Robin, who plays Robin. Trombone, I think.
So is it like the Marsalis family? Is this another Eubanks?
Well, it's definitely Eubanks. Let's see what our Wikipedia tells us, the official website of Trumpeter. A younger brother of Kevin and Robin. Yes, yeah, so he is the youngest Eubanks.
The youngest Eubanks. He probably doesn't like being called the youngest Eubanks.
He's a couple years younger than us, but yeah.
Right, I know. Well, yeah, when he's our age, he probably does like being called the youngest Eubanks. Well, anyway, I like him. I like him a lot. I like the trumpet playing on this album. I like it, Sam I Am. It's terrific. For whatever reason, maybe it's because the name checks Fred Hampton. Maybe it's for the pretty hot solos. I like the trumpet solos on Never Forget What They Did to Fred Hampton. I think it's pretty good. He gets to take a lot of choruses there. I'm going to say something about the drummer, leader date, Curtis Nowosad. This is a really good example, I think. I don't know if you like it or not. I think this is a good example of a drummer as the leader of a date, and he's a really good accompanist, but he takes the lead in interesting ways and he drives the action in good ways. I particularly like the opening of the opening cut. We've talked about it on the other two albums. We might as well talk about it here. Home Is Where the Hatred Is. It's a terrific start. A little sort of mini propulsive solo to get that number going. And I like his interventions almost uniformly throughout this album. So it's kind of interesting. Sometimes drummer-led dates, it's like, they're the leader, but they're the leader for whatever reason. And their voice on the album is recessive, you know, because they're not Art Blakey or whatever. This isn't Art Blakey, you know, but Curtis is interventionist. He's an interventionist drummer, and he's present, and he punctuates and accents in interesting and propulsive ways all the way through. I kind of like it. He's a little busy, but it's a good busy.
There you go. And that's a Gil Scott-Heron cover, I believe.
Right. Okay. That's cool. So yeah, I kind of like this, and I'm this might be in the rotation longer than all the other albums, just because it is enjoyable. Did you like it? What's your feeling?
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it certainly is staking some positions in terms of its political references. That said, it doesn't seem to bog down in didacticism. It doesn't seem to be, you know, trying too hard to make points. It's largely accomplished and entertaining music that, you know, also has some things to say. And that, I think, is a great blend. It's a little odd where it's like, you know, the tune dedicated to Hampton, it's kind of upbeat, you know?
Yeah.
You listen to it, you don't think of somebody being slipped drugs, so he sleeps through a raid and just being shot to death in his bed by police officers who are acting as executioners. You know, you just don't,
right.
That's not what it evokes. So there is a sense that maybe the front-loaded politics, as it were, of the song titles is almost misleadingly hard-edged, where the music itself is a little bit more welcoming and accessible than you might think it would be. You know, this is not Abby Lincoln singing spine-chilling songs and We Insist Now, the Freedom Suite or something. It's a little more welcoming musically. But yeah, I think it's good. I like the blending of, you know, covers that aren't from the Gas with originals. And I think it walks a line with being, you know, there's, you know, maybe a little bit of soul jazz in it.
Yeah.
But it never seems just kind of empty-headed or just prettified or background music. You know, there's content. It's just presented in a way that's it's got, you know, some groove to it. There's, you know, it's fairly accessible without ever being condescending or kind of empty-headed. So yeah, I like it a lot.
I'm gonna go out on a, not a limb, I guess, but I'm gonna say I prefer the numbers where the keyboardist is playing not piano. I like the numbers where he's playing electronic. Usually I don't, But here, I feel like it works better. A Hard Time Killing Floor Blues, Sea Lion Woman. I think his interplay with the guitarist on those, both those songs is stronger for the fact that, he's playing organ or whatever. I like those numbers better for that reason. And it gives the album a little bit of a kind of 70s feel maybe or something sometimes.
Well, some of the references too, you know, it's sure. Interesting because, you know, you bring up Hampton and it's at this point a long time ago. And it's not the shape right now that racial politics is taking. In other words, we don't, to my knowledge, have a very active or publicized Black Panther Party. You know, we have other ways of expressing dissatisfaction with race relations in America. It's just that's not per se the movement or the iconography that people are referring to now. So it's interesting, right? It's kind of a callback. And I, not being a student of Chicago history or of Black Panther history, I had to look it up. And I'm sorry, you know, we may have walked by. It's been a few years since we went to the gym in Chicago. So many things I've forgotten since then. Why I went to graduate school, for instance. Cannot recall at this point what the point of that was. Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know that in some ways, I guess it is almost like calling like there's going to be a little Curtis Mayfield here or something. Those are kind of the reference points. And I nothing wrong with that. So I enjoyed it. But it's odd in that it's not quite the call. You know, it's not like I Can't Breathe, which is a well-known kind of rallying cry from the last 10, 15 years. You know, it's a little more Sea Lion Woman that, you know, was popularized by Nina Simone or whatever. It's a different era of protest, you know, 60s and 70s rather than, say, 2000s, 2010s. But I like it. You know, I think it's a good record.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed it. Like I said, I think it might be my favorite of this week. And again, I think this is a model for how a drummer leads a date.
Right. It's not lots of drum solos, but it is an interventionist driving player who's shaping the performances without Buddy Riching it up or something.
Yeah, or Art Blakey.
There you go. Bump. Thump, thump. I can't remember. There was some other review copy we're probably not going to get to, but I was listening to it, and it was more of a kind of a sentimental spin, and the rhythm section just made me want to drive the car off the road. It's like, oh my God, this is like plotting in the dictionary. And, you know, I think they're trying for a certain kind of mood, whatever, but there are ways of doing that well, and that was not happening. So the opposite here, where you've got a very grooving, accomplished rhythm section, and yeah, there's a couple vocal numbers. Again, I spend the record wondering, well, how far on the crossover spectrum are we going to go here? And there's a little bit of wavering. You know, it's not, some of them are a little bit more straight, quote unquote, jazz. Some of them are more, you know, kind of straddling jazz with kind of a, you know, neo soul or something. But there's nothing, again, not a problem. And I think the rule set is a little bit more clearly, you know, the contract it's making with you is a little bit clearer. What it's about, you know, the sound world is creating is a little bit more consistent. Yeah, I highly recommend it. Again, the only record here that I say that this is probably the most, I like Spaza a lot, but the most focused of those two to me are the most successful in what they're trying to do. I like Crompton, but it's a little scattered. And then Baird is just, I've got this issue with Tenocracy, kind of, you know, you're really fast, sir. Slow down. So anyway, the last one was the one that I had a long time getting to terms with. I ended up liking it quite a bit and wrote it up. But I feel like this is a record that Spaza, that is going to be hard to kind of track down or fit into the cultural discourse. It's an album named after the group, which is Spaza. It's a South African collective of improvisers, and they kind of jammed on a day in 2015, and then clearly many things were done to their jamming. And so this record, which is much more of an astral trip than the others, was put together, and I like it a lot, but it's different. And it's not an album about, there's some improvisation on it, there's some hot trombone solos and whatever, but that's not what this is about. This is not a traditional verse chorus solo focused jazz album. So thoughts on Spaza?
Well, the first thing I want to ask is, did you like it simply because the third cut has the name of your father and son in it?
No. Yeah, the names of these cuts are art installations of themselves.
Let's not let you do this. Let's not let you. Actually, this will be fun. Go ahead. Try the first cut. What do you think that is?
I'd have to, again, here's the deal, dude. Let me see if I can find it. I don't have track listings, or not easily.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. You don't have it up. Magwinya Mangola White Liver.
There you go.
Followed by Sunlight Glycerin Two Loose Draws. And then the song I'm referring to, Five Rand, the name of your father and son. Airtime Nama Ever Ready 4,000 Degrees.
And someone followed brought by, Randy Rand from South Africa, so one of our members did. So.
Followed by Tiger Balm Nobulabako Interlude. Ice Squinchies Waiting for You, Invocations Interlude, and Stametta Spew It.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm glad you like this, and I'm glad I was able to read your review to figure out why you like this. I have not lived with this as long as you have, and so while I like it, my enthusiasm isn't at the level of yours yet. This, to me, is this spacey in like a Sun Ra way sometimes, except without, you know, other planets and Egypt and blah, blah, blah. But it has that kind of spacey out there, trippy feel, especially with some of the polyrhythms, the percussion, the treated percussion. One can only wonder what Sun Ra would have made of our brave new world of treated vocals. If Sun Ra had lived to the 21st century, I can only imagine he would produce things not unlike this. Although, of course, talking about returning to our planet of origin and so forth. But so, yeah, I like this, but man, I have a hard time wrapping my head around it. I think I would like you to explain to the class why this is jazz.
Your finest hour will I wait for the day.
I don't have to defend it that way. I don't think it's necessary. There are elements, right? And it's, I think, in the case of so much creative music, where do you find a home? Where do you look for listeners? This is a pool of listeners that I think will find this music appealing. Like I said, I don't think it does resemble jazz a lot.
So what genre would you call this?
Well, this is the point. I think this is a difficulty. Is that, you know, the first track, I think, will remind people of a certain age of Remain in Light,
yeah,
right? There's some
fair
sounds there that both from the African rhythms, which are actually, you know, all made by Africans here, South Africans, and some of the guitar sounds getting across the speakers there, I think are a little bit reminiscent of Adrian Belew and his Pomp in the early 80s. So that, you know, made me a happy boy because I have happy memories of that music. I love the vocal treatments. They are heavily treated. This is the first time I've ever heard a auto-tuner used in a way that did not make me want to gag.
Yeah.
In a way, I am just hard-pressed to understand how something that seems so organically unfolding and coherent and shapely in certain ways was just kind of improvised off the cuff in one afternoon at the Spaza Art Gallery. It's mind-bending, and I assume a lot of what's going on here, along with musicianship of a very high order, is the post-production, the interwining of these elements into this kind of narrative shape. I'm, I, I just, I don't see any other way it could have happened, that there was a lot of post-creation editing. But then, you know, you think back to like Miles Davis's projects, which again, you know, the ongoing polyrhythms and everything, it doesn't sound anything like Bitches Brew or, you know, the late Electric stuff in his first period in the 70s. What am I trying to think of here? What's the really Dark Magus or something? But it's not miles removed from this idea of groove. It's just that instead of solo instruments, you have these vocal riffs that are treated and piled on top of one another that make, you know, something that I think is like a distorted view of a kind of almost a pop experience. You know, they're shapes and recurrent elements. And I, like I said, I think it's awesome. But I wouldn't say this is much like Saxophone Colossus. You know, it's
no, just, okay.
That's not what we're getting.
Probably
here.
People will call this world music or something. I mean,
yeah,
right. For my money, so I like this. The cut that stuck with me, interestingly, the longest was the longest cut, 5 Rand Airtime Nama Every Day,
right. Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. And that's because Ever Ready 4000 Degrees. Sorry, that's the full title. And that's because it has this repeated vocal riff that is kept for much of the 13, 14 minutes running time of the song, but then it alters slightly. So that vocal riff becomes part of the scaffolding on which the song hangs. And when you take the song apart, it's kind of weird. There's not that much there. There's the percussion, which sounds very much to me like bongos or congas or whatever. And then those vocal riffs, which are then layered over that. And then I guess it's the trombone has been, there's a trombone player here and his playing is treated and it's layered into that. And that song I really, really like. And that one's kind of recognizable to me. When it comes on, I'm like, oh, yeah, this. And it's just this really, it's a really cool groove. And it doesn't feel like it goes on too long. It's just terrific. I mean, I really like that song. It's not that I don't like the other songs. It's just that that's the one I kind of grokked. That's the one where I was like, oh, yeah, this works. I really dig this. But that's pretty much the template here, right? It's just vocals, treated vocals, kind of layered over one another with some propulsive percussion, but not very, it's minimalist. It's not a kit. It's hand drums of some kind. And I've looked at the personnel, and I swear to God, I hear a didgeridoo on here or something like that. And I don't know what that actually would be. Maybe that's the trombone treated, you know, but it sounds like
there's some heavy treatment going on all over the place.
One of those weird aboriginal horns.
Yeah.
Maybe that's treated trombone. I don't know. When you look at what they built this out of, you're like, it's got to be more than that. There has to be more because there isn't that much stuff here that they layer.
And they're fairly simple harmonic cells. You know, this is it is not free opera improvisation. You know, this is not atonal.
No,
it's much more riff based. You know, I brought up in the review Kamasi Washington because my sense is that these epic, some call the epic albums that he makes, which go back to the kind of soul jazz of Alani Liston Smith or whatever, you know, it's kind of music that's trying to force a feeling of transcendence on you. And for the most part, I just think layering on more strings and choruses and things doesn't work. But this album, I do feel like, takes you on a trip. And it's weird, but it's got its own inner logic. And it is, you know, it's not about virtuoso blowing. It's not about really super complex arrangements. It's more that you'll have these ebbs and flows of fairly simple elements, and to me at least, they know how to string them together into something that's organic and satisfying. You know, that a long song, it'd be kind of hard to point to what were the major incidents here, what was the melody. You know, I was like, not. But at the end of it, I feel like, yeah, that journey, whether it's 5 minutes or 11 or whatever, works. You know, it hangs together somehow, and I feel like the mind that is doing this is working with, you know, the brilliantly generated elements, but is more the producer as much as anything, that he's kind of the god mind that's put this together and made a story out of it. But I just don't know. I'd be fascinated to know, were they doing some of these treatments on the fly when they performed this? I mean, were they, you know, I just don't know. You know, were they taking these vocals and looping them and layering them and pitch shifting them and the rest of it live? Or did they do that late? I'd be fascinated to find out. But to me, on its own terms, which are pretty unique, I like it. But it is very difficult to pigeonhole. The musicians on it aren't well-known names. The ensemble, obviously, is a brand new name. I just don't, you know, what is Spaza? Well, listen to it a few times with or without the drug of your choice and let me know, you know. But how it's going to find listenership, I don't
that
know.
That is a good piece of advice. We, you know, we ought to do this more often. Albums to trip to. This is definitely an album that you would want to get high to. Not an album to do coke to, but an album to do like a psychedelic to. So if you're into shrooms, if you smoke a bowl now and again, if you're one of those people who still drop a tab of acid, this is your album. This is what you trip to. Don't do coke to this. That's not going to help. But yeah,
don't do new coke to it, because it doesn't even taste right.
We should imitate other podcasts and have a segment. Today's segment on albums to listen to while high.
There you go. Well,
Yeah, this would be good for that, actually. Now that you mention it, it would be.
I enjoy it without the help of drugs. It works its magic on me and puts me in that state of mind without having to pay a dealer. So, hooray. But yeah, I like it a lot. Again, it's not a traditional jazz album. And, you know, some people may just not be able to get into the sound world it creates or like these drifting loop. You know, at one point, I think I say it's less like, what do I compare the vocals to?
Smurfs.
There we go. That's right.
So for those who don't know, Pat has done a written review of this album for All About Jazz, which you can look up. If you just look up Spaza and All About Jazz, you can see Pat's review of the album there. I know I did before I came on the cast today. So
there you go.
Yeah. Cliff's Notes for lazy people.
Apparently, according to the promo guy, that's sort of what they're looking for. So God bless me, because I couldn't have said with any confidence that's what they were trying to do. I just could say what I heard. But yeah, it's a cross between Crickets and Smurfs. Yes. But to me, again, I'm fascinated because so often the use of electronic manipulation seems so templated. Like, you're doing to this vocal what 400 producers before you did to it. It's an imitation of one sound that evokes one emotion, and that has been done to death and just makes me want to despair. Like the auto-tune sound of the love song, where it's just like, doesn't this make you want to punch the singer? Is there any other reaction to this other than just wanting to do violence upon the person who is singing this way? And these guys are, whatever it is they're doing, it's different. You may not like it, but it's creative. It's not just one more fucking auto-tune vocal line. So I liked it.
Good. I liked it too, but not as articulately or in as much detail as you did.
There you go. Wasn't easy, folks.
Your black leather jacket. Is it you or your parents in this income tax bracket? Now tickets to concerts and drinking at clubs. Sometimes for music that you haven't even heard of. And how much did you pay for your rock and roll t-shirt that proves you were there, that you heard of them first? Now, how do you afford your rock and roll lifestyle? How do you afford your rock and roll lifestyle? How do you afford your...
Pop Matters, anything on your mind?
Sure. Two things, and they're both derived from you, actually. So recently, back into the hopper, for whatever reason, my randomness, is Cake's Motorcade of Generosity. What a lot of fun Cake was. I mean, weren't they fun? And honestly, has there been a better satire of people worshiping rock bands than Rock and Roll Lifestyle? What a brilliant fucking song. It's just brilliant. It just sort of takes apart what it is to be a fan and holds it up and mocks the shit out of it. It's just a terrific little song. And really, you got to like a band that features a trumpet player, a rock band that features a trumpet player, just as like part of their gestalt. So that's a lot of fun. And that's been in the rotation recently. And then you hooked me up with an Oingo Boingo this very day. An Oingo Boingo that I had not heard before. Is that, you get that on vinyl? Is that what happened?
Yeah, I've had that for years. It's their second album. And I think both of us had on cassette, Good for Your Soul, their third album.
And Dead Man's Party.
I've never owned or heard Dead Man's Party through. I mean, I've heard tracks from it, but.
Okay.
And this one I did not, I think I appreciated it more. I don't appreciate the fact that it ends with a song called like Lizards and Samurai. I just,
Reptiles and Samurai
for almost 6 minutes. It's just,
yeah.
there's a fine line between funny, stupid and stupid, stupid. And I think it may have crossed that line.
Yeah, no, I, sort of the quintessential Oingo Boingo songs here would be something like Grey Matter or, Nothing to Fear But Fear Itself. Those to me are like, those are the essence of Oingo Boingo. But for sheer pleasure, Wild Sex in the Working Class is brilliant. It's just, I'm teaching Marx right now, and I feel like I should start class on Monday with Oingo Boingo singing Wild Sex in the Working Class. What a great, obnoxious song that is. I mean, seriously, what the hell is wrong with them?
So many things.
Just great fun. That they are just an enormous amount of fun. You really can't say anything bad about them in terms of, you know, they don't aim high and they hit what they aim at. And you got to like a band that is that committed to stupid.
You know? That's right. They embrace it wholeheartedly.
Stupid matters, and this is what we're doing, and we're going to be stupid, goddammit. So, yeah, it's a... I'm glad you hooked me up with that. Did you get your part two of your belated birthday present, or has it not arrived yet?
I have not, to my knowledge.
All right. Okay. All right. So it's still on its way. I had hoped that part one of your birthday present was, what's his name?
Wayne Shorter. Yeah, we should do that too.
We should, because a birthday present for you is also a birthday present for me. But yeah, I'm very interested to know what you think of the other thing. All right, well, okay. Cool. I was something else I was going to mention, and I can't. It's gone out of my head. So you tell me your pop matters, and probably while you're talking, I'll think of it. Go ahead.
Sure. One is not a pop matter, but a call out. As I mentioned before, my family and I went to Cincinnati last weekend. Cincinnati is a city on hard times. I had not quite realized it. And we stayed in a hotel on hard times. And the southern part of the downtown, which is where we were closest, was a bit rough. But I did get to a couple record stores. The one I'd recommend is Torn Light Records. And they had a really good jazz section, and among other things I picked up was the 13 LP set of Art Tatum's solo masterpieces. So we've had that on CD for years. I've now got an LP. I don't think it sounds a lick better. It's just more an active, just homage to Art. But it'll give me an excuse to play through it again at least. And, you know, as I said, there's a couple of cool finds there that I'm hoping to bring one of those on the podcast or at least ship it to you to listen to. And I got this Art Tatum thing. The other pop matter is, along with dubbing Oingo Boingo. And the one reason I was thinking of that album is that first song, Grey Matter, my son is currently studying dark matter in his summer internship. So I'm going to send it to him and tell him to rewrite the lyrics because it somehow seems appropriate. They'd all be chanting dark matter, it's hard to find. I also taped at your request Joe's Garage Parts 2 and 3. So that has just arrived in your inbox.
I still need Joe's Garage Part 1, I think.
Yeah, you do. And I remember knowing those songs, but I don't think I ever owned. I must have had a tape or something.
Was that Brian's, maybe?
Maybe. I don't know. So, yeah, I guess if you want the complete set.
If you want the complete set of total misogyny, that is Zappa at his most misogynist.
God. And just
it's really an irresponsible. It's very funny, and it's completely wrong. We can't even say the names of the songs. It's so
yeah. On one, I think it's side the second side of this of part two. Two of the three songs are about being anally raped in jail. The third one is not. But right. Yeah.
It does have a song you can actually mention, which is the epic "Why Does It Hurt When I Pee?"
And that's again in part one. You know, those are kind of the more popular, memorable songs on the first disc. And then there's supposedly one of his greatest guitar solos. It's one of the instrumentals. And the other memorable thing about this record is just him saying, "This is a central scrutinizer." You know that.
Right.
In
right.
a way, he's so intense, and the whispering, it's a very distinctive, distorted sound, and he is both on the edge of laughing at the stupidity of what he's saying and also kind of committed to it. And that's what I remember, you know, the white zone is for loading and unloading and that little narrative bit. And then the songs aren't quite songs in many cases on parts two and three. There's obviously impressive musicianship, and some of this guitar soloing is quite good, and Little Green Rosetta is a fine tune. Some ways, I mean, I think it's got the deepest meaning of anything he put there. He thought it was the silliest song, but it's the only one I think really had anything to say, which is nothing.
You know, he's just an endlessly fascinating guy, because I think he is a genius, but I also think he's an asshole as well. And the genius and the asshole are closely allied. Like, they are not far apart.
Yeah.
You can't really separate them. So for, you know, Joe's Garage shows the asshole side of him more than the genius, but they're never far apart. I was listening to one of the live, I can't remember if it was something you gave me or something else, but I was listening to one of the live discs, and he's called out people to dance to this ridiculous.
Oh yeah, you mentioned that before, right? Yeah.
Solo. And on the one hand, it's really funny, and on the other hand, it's just really wrong. Because the people aren't dancing well enough, and he's kind of mocking them for their inability to dance to this impossible solo. And you just think, wow, he really hates people, doesn't he? Like, he hates his band, and he hates his fans. He's mocking everyone.
Well, if you remember, like, early SNL, there was this fascination in 70s humor with Smarm, you know, the guy at Vegas. It was basically my parents' generation of entertainers were so insincere, and they were just fascinated by it in a way that went beyond entertaining. I mean, some of their imitations of the nightclub singer weren't really that intrinsically insightful or funny. It's just like, look, here's somebody being smarmy. And it's like, okay, sure. And I just, you know, it's this weird kind of curdled response to what the Beatles supposedly represented of, you know, we're going to bring authenticity, self-expression, and replace, you know, people in tuxedos singing other people's music to a bunch of grandmothers. And this is going to be real, and that was fake. And then, you know, the more you study music and performance strategies, the more you look at what happened to rock and roll and whatever else, it's like, well, that was a really silly division. I mean, yes, of course, there were very smarmy, insincere performers in Holiday Inns across the nation, but there's also a lot of rockers who are just absolute full of bullshit. And, you know, there's some great people work, you know, you're going to say that Billie Holiday more or less did this. She played in nightclubs and sang other people's music. It's just a stupid division. But man, 70s were fascinated with it. And he loves that. He loves to do that, that kind of role of the smarmy, insincere MC. It can be funny if he's riffing, you know, but it just isn't. It's not like it exposes something about the world that just soul shatters me, you know. Oh, my God. Yeah, it's just silly.
Yeah, well, like I said, I mean, I think I'm going to stand by my analysis. He is a stone-cold genius, and he is a raving asshole. And the thing is, the two are just really hard to separate.
You can't, the chimera is all knit together.
There are moments when he's brilliant, but they're always really tightly allied to the moments where he's a complete prick. But yeah, he was a genius. I think that's fair to say.
And, well, anyway, you got part two and three. One's on YouTube. I don't know where it could be found, but I will
look for it. And I will find it, and I will requite you.
And that concludes Jazz Bastard Podcast 171. If you're happy and you know it, you can send us an email at mike@jazzbastard.com or pat@jazzbastard.com. Or you can drop us a line at our Facebook page. Or if you like, look me up on All About Jazz. The podcast can be downloaded from www.jazzbaster.com, from Apple Podcasts, from Stitcher, from Mixcloud, and can occasionally be streamed from All About Jazz. Tune in next time as we do an episode I'm really looking forward to cutting. It's going to be called What's Your Concept? It's roughly speaking about jazz concept albums, and it includes work by Wynton Marsalis, Gerald Wilson, Henry Threadgill, Herbie Mann, and The Session. Till next time, take care. Mr. Crompton's album.
Compton.
Yeah, I don't... Crompton, right? Is it Crompton or Compton? Have I gone mad?
Now I just moved away from...
It's Crompton. I found his webpage. He offers saxophone lessons, clarinet lessons, keyboard lessons, piano lessons, and other kinds of lessons. He teaches in New York City. Could not find a biography page for him because I think there's also a football player with his name. So he's dominating Wikipedia, the football player. I'm not saying this guy can't play football. I don't know, but you know, he's more of a sax guy.
Okay, half wandering. So.
All right, very well summed, Mr. Sidecar. So our next selection.
You're wandering into NFL football.
Absolutely. You know, this is important to know. That if you look for Crompton, you're going to find...
Occasionally, the guy in the sidecar just has to smack the driver upside the head.
You know, the great thing about motorcycles is you can drive them over cliffs. That's there's nothing preventing, you know, if you've got the handlebars, there's trouble ahead.
I'll sit back quiet again.